don't claim to have any special knowledge. I'm just your average guy asking questions. One time I didn't believe in the Lord. I still don't believe in the resurrection. I know it happened. If you were with us yesterday, you saw a lot of evidence outside of the scriptures that can't be answered if it didn't happen. And some people, I used to think I believed in the resurrection, but 1 Peter keeps saying that, chapter 1, 21. Peter's not telling us to believe in the resurrection. No. The resurrection happened, he told the Christians, as a fact. Now, he didn't use that word, but look what he said. The resurrection happened. God raised him from the dead and glorified him so that you can have faith and hope in God, who you can't see. That tells me, living in 2018, since Peter's writing to all Christians through all eras, that he's writing to me. If they had proof that God raised Jesus from the dead, because God's saying, look, I don't want you to have blind faith. I'm going to give you some evidence. And he's saying to them, because God raised him from the dead as a fact. That's what he's telling them. Then you can believe in God. And Paul, talking to the philosophers on Mars Hill. What did he tell them? God raised Jesus Christ so that you could be assured that you can believe in the resurrection? No, he raised Jesus Christ so you can be sure that his wrath is coming. You don't see that. You can't see the future, but you can see this. Again, both Peter, both Paul, both of them telling me there's got to be something here that is provable to show the fickle guy like me that this happened. And that's why I call the series Proving the Resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, you can't really prove a supernatural event. That's impossible, especially when it happened 2,000 years ago. But you can be sure that it happened if we look at the evidence. I don't know if you've been in courts as a jurist. I had the occasion and the honor to do that a couple times. Interesting. You had to make sure that you were not part of the event, the crime, the murder, whatever it was. You had to be sure that they had to make sure you didn't know anything about it, because you're going to be presented evidence on the things that happened. But when you got done with that, what were they expecting of you? To know it happened enough that you can find guilt or innocence. I wasn't there. In the case that I was in, I wasn't there. But by the time I got done with all the evidence that both sides, I saw it happened. And so that's what I mean by proving it. Enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to know it happened, because what are we doing here if it didn't? What are we doing here if we did? Because if it didn't happen, what a gentleman said earlier, we're to be most pitied. Believing a hoax? I'll just close the book if it didn't happen. In fact, that's what Paul said, right? Didn't Paul say that? If it didn't happen, you Christians, I'm a liar. You can't believe a word I said. And that means you and I can't believe half the things in the New Testament, because he wrote half the books. But my non-believing friend over here tells me it was invented. The resurrection and the whole concept of Christianity was invented, was made up by someone's imagination. Really? So the first thing I asked them, where's the proof? Where's the evidence that shows it was invented? That's the first thing I ask. Is there any? What we do find in history is the Roman historians tells us, as we saw yesterday and earlier this morning, that Christianity spread across the empire as if overnight, starting from nothing. zero. And it did it fast in the first century, not 300, 400, 500 years. And as we just saw recently, no historic movement, no man has ever caused a movement to grow like that, to be developed like that. Who was this man? Everyone knows his name. Believers, atheists, non-skeptics, everyone knows his name. That's the question of the ages. Who was this man? You may have heard of C.S. Lewis, philosopher, 19th century. He tried to answer that question using the best logical arguments you can come up with, really, in his day. And they were very good arguments. He said, Jesus Christ was one of three things. He was either a liar, because he lied, things he said, if he's not who he said he is, right? He's a liar. Well, how can a liar, and a liar that was humiliated, remember on that, what we talked about, the crucifixion, destroyed the man's reputation? You tell me this man is a liar, and yet he goes out and teaches other people don't lie. Kind of flies in the face of nonsense. Had the greatest impact on the history of man? Our calendar starts with him. Oh, wait a minute. No, we got the common era today. It's not BC. I mean, it's not AD, right? Well, what is the common era? After Christ. I mean, that's when it started. It's before that. We named our, we count our years by this man. A liar could have had that effect. Second option is, oh, he's crazy. He's a lunatic. You know, some people thought that in the first century. His brothers did. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But really, same thing. Can a lunatic have this kind of impact on the man, on mankind in history? A crazy man? Can you think of a crazy man in our era? Yeah, I can think of a few. Many of you too young, Charles Manson. Real crazy man. He had a following of a handful of women. What kind of impact does he have? Nothing positive on that guy. A crazy man has that kind of impact? Impossible. Or the third option, Mr. Lewis said, then he has to be the Lord. There's no other option. He's got to be who he says he is. Well, time passed. And non-believers didn't have an answer. But now they do. There's a third, fourth L. The three L's, liar, lunatic. They come up with a fourth L. Well, they had to, because these three arguments, these logical arguments, were just too hard to overcome. You have to walk away and say, okay, you know, I don't care. And you walk away. But dealing with it logically, what's the answer? Well, the third or the fourth one says he was a legend. And that's that, I'm pointing back to that invented thing. Just a legend. Oh, yeah, they accepted that he was a historical person. They accepted he was a great teacher, and he had a lot of disciples, and he wasn't a liar, he wasn't a lunatic. Because they can't deny any of that evidence. But after his death, his disciples began to tell these stories. And that's where we left off last time. The stories of Jesus Christ. That's all it was. You Christians, you're crazy. You're foolish. You believe in stories. I mean, that's what I've been told. Myths about him being God, claiming to be divine. It's impossible. You see, that's the mindset of today. Just like it was the mindset of the first century, where they said it was impossible to reverse death. There's no way, the Gentiles said, you can reverse death. A physical body coming out of the tomb, impossible. Well, I'll tell you that's impossible myself. But that was so impossible, even Paul was struggling with that concept in the church. Because you Christians in Corinth were believing we're not raised from the dead. Oh, yeah, I accept Jesus Christ as saved and he was raised, but for me personally, no, that doesn't work. What did Paul say? If there is no such thing as a resurrection, guys, then the Christ was never raised from the dead. You can't have it both ways. That was the mindset. Today our mindset is, he's a myth. Satan works overtime every century. He is a myth. Okay, let's look at it from that option for a moment. Besides the fact that we addressed in these last four lessons, I hope you get a chance, if you weren't here, the chance to hear the audio. I'm going to have a video of it too in a few weeks, and that'll show you some of the slides with it. Because there's a lot of facts and information we went into that was building up to what we're talking today about. There's a major problem with the theory that he was a legend. If he was a legend, and if he was invented, who did it? Who invented the legend? A human being had to invent it. I'm a non-believer. I don't even believe in God. So if it's a legend and you guys are believing a lie, then I have to tell you that it's a human being that made it. Right? Someone from Mars didn't come here to do it. Who did it? How was this thing invented? Who's the major inventor? You know who he is. This guy called Paul. He invented this movement. And that means Jesus was not the one who had the major impact. Because Jesus really never did anything he said he did. Paul invented it all. So then that means it's Paul who invented what you believe. Paul invented all of these magnificent teachings, right? Paul. Non-believer. From the non-believer's point of view. Not from my Christian. I wear two hats. Sometimes I get mixed up, maybe, and you guys think I'm saying the wrong thing. Forgive me. Well, if Paul invented this story that you are believing and you're accepting, then we can use the same logic with Paul. Is he a liar? How could a liar tell everybody else not to lie? How can a liar do all these things and have the greatest impact? If it's Paul, nobody else. How could he, this liar, have this impact? Same reasons that we said for Jesus. Same thing about lunatic. How can a lunatic be a crazy man having this kind of impact on humanity? Well, what's the other option then? If he's not a liar, he's not a lunatic. He's the Lord's servant. That's who he said he was. First of all, when was Paul alive? When was he living? He was living in the first century. Right in the middle of the first century. And he is responsible for half of the New Testament. The very things we're reading. He personally wrote, I think it's 13 of them, of the 27 letters. And what are those letters about? Him? Oh, it's a little bit about him, but it's things about, shameful things about him. It's about Jesus Christ. It's about the subject at hand. He wrote half of it, and it's about Jesus. And what's interesting is that half of the letters that he wrote, half of the letters that this man wrote are accepted by modern historians and scholars. They don't doubt it. It's genuine as far as they're concerned. Now, the other ones, I personally believe in all of his letters, but I'm only going to deal with the seven that are accepted by the majority of historians, because my believing friend here, my non-believing friend rather, doesn't accept fairy tales. And only he can go with is what he knows is accurate from history. At least I'm hoping that's what he would at least do. I have an open mind on that. And so let's look at I'm not going to look at all the letters, but I'm just going to tell you that the letters that are genuinely written by Paul are genuinely written by Paul. No one disputes them. He's not a liar. He's not a crazy man. He wrote these things, and they accept that. You can go to the Britannica, Encyclopedia Britannica, to find that out too. Are they a Christian organization? By no means. You can't, do I have the link up? The link's not going to do good. That's too small. Again, I'm going to send, I'll make available all of the references and things that I've used over the years as a PDF form. It'll include a lot of links and other things. Therefore, we know that Paul, as a matter of fact, was a real person living in the first century. He was not a legend. And he wrote documents that are exclusively about Jesus Christ. And if we simply read those letters, and that's what I hope we're all doing, not only on the first day of the week, but also other days of the week, reading these most important letters. If we read these letters, then we can know something about what he thinks and what his arguments are. What is he saying? What's he trying to say? And these are letters that we can look at that no one's disputing. And we all know initially, everyone knows initially, what about Paul? We know he was an enemy of Christ. Everyone knows that. Even our non-believing friends could know that because they can read the letters that Paul wrote because he mentions it in those letters. He's not proud of it, but in fact, he's ashamed of it. 1 Corinthians 15:9, Galatians 1:3. These are facts that Paul writes about himself being an enemy. In fact, some people even considered him the number one enemy. I would. Yeah. Number one enemy. You remember when it started? He was right there holding the coat as they stoned Philip. I'm sorry, Stephen. Philip was stoned by the Jews later. And this means, therefore, that we have documentation, letters written from the first century by a man that the world accepts as real. Real letters, we don't dispute them. No one disputes them. And that's where I'm at with my non-believing friend. That's where I am talking from. Because he won't accept what I believe in the scriptures. But he has to accept these things. And as an enemy based in Jerusalem, that means that he had everything at his disposal. He's an enemy, right? Forget he's Paul. He's Saul. And he's an enemy. And we know what he was doing as an enemy. And he had at his disposal everything. He had a powerful position. He's a Pharisee. He can go around and check and to demonstrate all of these falsehoods about Christ. He can go and look and see, ooh, no empty tomb. I'm sorry, no body in the tomb. I don't know what was going through his mind as the enemy of Christ, but I know he had to go. He's not just going to ignore those things because that's what he's hearing these crazy, foolish Christians talking about. He could have searched for the body. He could search for all the tricks and whatever else you guys are up to trying to bring this blasphemy out. This violent enemy of this movement, of course he could have done these things, and I'm very suspect that he did. As a modern skeptic, that's something that needs to be considered and to thought about this man, Paul. Mr. Non-believer, please help me with this. Paul, the fact that this kind of man can be converted to Christianity from where he came from is another question I can't answer from the natural causes. Remember, we're talking about last lesson, comparing natural causes. Because we can't look at supernatural causes, because as a non-believer, there's no such thing. So, okay, what are the natural causes that brought this about, this movement, this man Paul, who was Saul, really, and he left Judaism because of this. It's not an insignificant thing that this man did what he did. When you want to speak about the movement, which is going against all common sense, from the stuff we saw already in the last four lessons. This man's history is also important. He was no ordinary man. The conversion of this man must be explained without the resurrection. That's what we're looking at, things that happen without the resurrection. He considered it blasphemy to go against the God that he served. Born in Tarsus. Combining his name again, Tarsus, a Pharisee. He probably did believe that lie. Remember, we talked about the lie. We had evidence from the second century that that lie was still perpetrated. Jews were believing, having that conversation with, who was that? I forgot who it was. I forgot who it was, but Trypho, the rabbi, was speaking to him and said, everyone knows the body was stolen. Come on. You see, and that confirms what Mark had said. The body was, a lie was being told about that. So Paul had that opportunity, and he said, you guys are blasphemers, and you need to be eradicated. You see, we talked about how they were being eradicated by Rome and then other citizens. Paul started it. He's the one that needed and wanted to serve his God and eradicate these blasphemers. You got to realize his mindset, where he's at, and then ask, huh? He changed? Because from a materialistic standpoint, what did he gain? What would he have gained from going over to the other side to become a Christian? Absolutely nothing. In 2 Corinthians, and throughout most of 2 Corinthians, it's an established letter of his. The whole letter is established. Everyone knows he has it. And we can see, as I mentioned before, that he admits he was a bitter enemy. He was the chief persecutor. But then after, he became the persecuted. He knew what it was like to be on that side because he was inflicting it, and now he's on this side receiving it. Chased, hunted down like an animal, stoned, beaten, placed in chains, put in something that would be considered a high security prison. And then finally he was executed. Paul was executed, never recanting, never turning back on his story of what he was saying and what he was writing about a man, Jesus, who hung on a humiliating cross that Rome was successful in destroying the man's reputation. Remember the evidence we saw about that? Jesus' reputation was destroyed. He was worthless. And Paul dies for this guy? Maybe I wasn't asking the right questions when I was a non-believer. That needs to be explained, just like the story of how the Christian movement came about. There's answers that can't be given from a natural point of view, at least in my opinion. And I keep asking. I don't know you. Many of you I don't know. And I hope there are some non-believers here. And I hope that you take advantage of the time to come. Or thank you, Kevin and Emily, for opening your home. Because I do like talking about these things. And I don't always get through everything we talk about in my material. And I do want to talk more about it. I can't stop talking about it because it's the most important thing in my life. If there was no resurrection, this man's conversion would be considered a miracle, comparable to the resurrection itself. And then for critics, for non-believers, to not come up with an answer, I mean, that's insulting my intelligence. You're telling me I have a blind faith? The story of this amazing turnaround in one day was only part of the argument. Not only did he miraculously turn around, but he was also the most successful person to spread this hoax. From the non-believer's point of view, it's a hoax. Yeah. How do you explain that? Paul was so successful in spreading this foreign, this strange, evil religion. And that's what they called it. We have historical documentation of that. Tacitus called it evil. And Paul was the most successful. How do you explain that? He's first an enemy of the movement, and then he's the driving force of the movement. I mean, we're looking for natural reasons. This is a natural historical fact. Let's continue. Naturally. How did this happen? Doesn't make sense from a naturalistic point of view, does it? Especially when you consider the statement that he made here. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain. This is Paul speaking. And your faith is in vain. because it's a hoax, right? Non-believer point of view, right? Okay. We are even found to be misrepresenting God because we testified about God that he raised Christ, whom he did not raise, if it's true that the dead are not raised. You see what he was arguing? You Christians, some of you Christians, you don't believe the dead are raised, and if that's the case. So what is he? I get the impression this is not Paul's idea. This is God's message. And we know he wasn't successful because of his great ability to speak. I mean, I don't have that. No, I don't know. You know, I just don't have that. He didn't have that. He admits that. When I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech and wisdom. It wasn't his good looks either. He had scars all over his face from being beaten and stoned to death. And then he says, and I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not implausible words of wisdom. That's his mental condition. His physical condition, his speaking ability. These things were done in fear and in trembling. But he didn't stop. He had the courage to continue, in fact, in spite of everything he was facing. Everything he was telling guys like you and me was not based on his talents, was not based on his personal insight, what he thought, and yet you believed it. Question remains, from the skeptic's vantage point, how could he be so successful by just speaking words? Coupled with his inabilities to speak and talk. I don't know how he talked, but it wasn't something of great grandeur because it wasn't about him. It was the message. So the question remains, how did this happen from the non-believer's point of view? And then add to that, that he was speaking to a group of people who thought the whole idea was ridiculous. The whole idea of resurrection is ridiculous. Now, we can identify with that. I live in a world. You live in a world that thinks this is ridiculous. And that's why we're not overflowing with standing room up there and bigger places. It's ridiculous. The world back then thought it was ridiculous. And you're trying to tell me, Mr. Non-Believer, natural causes of this man, Paul, started this and brought this about? No one's interested in the resurrection. There's no personal gain. You lost everything. I'm trying to tell you to become a Christian, and what are you going to do next week? Haul you off to prison. You going to want some of that? No, I don't want some of that. Naturally, I'm talking naturalistically. How can these things happen? You're taking a risk. Just believe in what this man says and look at the scars on his face. Anything but favorable. The conditions were not favorable by any stretch of the imagination. I was talking with people from different cultures, different religious beliefs, different ideology, different politics. Hey, that's our world too. If he can do it, maybe we can too. Because none of them would have been motivated for any reason to believe what he said. It was the opposite. You'd be quickly more encouraged, more motivated to reject what he said. And again, we have proof of that for ourselves today. Unless it was supported by something more than just his words. Right? So it looks like our non-believing friends have to make a choice. What do you believe? Do you believe the miracle of the resurrection? Nah, can't happen. Or do you believe the miracle or facts about Paul? One or the other. Because Christianity is here. How did it get here? If it wasn't the resurrection, then what's the natural thing? Paul. That's a miracle then, because look at what he was facing. Look what everything was going on. Which miracle do you want to believe? When you look at the natural history of real things that really happened and the mechanisms that existed there, those things would have been prevented, would have prevented it to happen. That's why I keep saying Christianity should have failed. And I know you heard it 100 times already. Because it should have failed under natural conditions. so many questions that I can't answer, that we can't answer, if the resurrection didn't happen. And Paul's only one part of that. All the evidence that we've been looking at, and there's a lot. Like I said, 13 hours of my material, I had to bring down to 5, so I left out a lot, and I didn't even finish everything I had to say. There's a lot of information, but it's powerful. It is very powerful. It confirms that Jesus was a living person, a real person in the first century, that he was executed. The plaster art that we saw from the second century, right? The Alexamenos Graffito, how it proved that Jesus's reputation was destroyed. It was a mockery that this Christian would worship that kind of God. Remember, we saw that? The head of a donkey on this figure drawn out on this cross. Evidence that his reputation was destroyed. We saw the diary of Perpetua. 20-year-old woman. Some of you are in that age range. Rich woman. Living around she died at 200 AD. She chose to go to the Colosseum instead of paying honor to Caesar. Because paying honor to Caesar was cursing Jesus, and this woman wouldn't do that. Her family begged her, "Don't do this, Perpetua. Your baby's going to be thrown on a garbage heap if you do this." Remember, she had the baby while she was in prison. What motivates her to do that? We have evidence this happened, plus thousands of others like her, willing to die like this. For what? Concept that the world thought was crazy? What you believe in, the world thought it was crazy then. They think it's crazy today too, but that this is the world they lived in. We heard from the famous skeptic, remember, Gerd Ludemann? He's a skeptic. He doesn't believe in the resurrection, right? But he does accept the evidence of hundreds and hundreds of people claiming to see Jesus after his death. He accepts that. Why? Because the evidence, you can't ignore it. But he doesn't want to accept the resurrection, so he says, well, it was just hallucinations, visions. Well, we know that that's impossible. Hallucinations are scientifically impossible, mass hallucinations like that. We heard from others, too. This fellow here, let me get to that slide, Pincus Lapide, famous Jewish historian. He acknowledged that there were 530. He's a historian. He acknowledges it, 530. Well, there was more than that, but one time, right? There was more than 500 that saw Jesus alive. And what did he say? He said that, wow, it's a good thing that only those 530 people saw it, because if everybody in Jerusalem saw Jesus, they'd all be converted. Facts. Eyes don't deceive. When you see the evidence, yeah, it's there. But even more profound, I don't know if I did this slide or not, but anyway, I'm going to do it again for those who didn't see it. He makes this statement. If the defeated and depressed group of disciples overnight could change into a victorious movement of faith based only on autosuggestion or self-deception without a fundamental faith experience, then this would be a much greater miracle than the resurrection of Christ. He wrote that in his book, Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective. All of the evidence we've been looking at, putting it all together over these 5 lessons, doesn't even scratch the surface. It's just there, if we want to bother looking at it. And these men looked at the evidence. These are men that use logic and reason. They don't have... He doesn't have a reason to say that, except that's what he notices, that's what he sees. It's all based on evidence, which leads me now to this. Evidence, that's what we've been talking about, evidence. Did you ever hear of Simon Greenleaf? Any lawyers in the audience? If you're a lawyer, you may have heard of Simon Greenleaf. He lived during the 19th century, and he was served as dean professor at the law of Harvard. Brilliant man, very brilliant, and he's still recognized today as one of the great authors of books, college books, to teach lawyers how to deal with and work with evidence. In fact, what I understand, his books are still being used in law studies and law schools. His books, his textbooks, teach lawyers the principles of the rule of evidence. Let me get his book up here. Because what he did was, he knew when information was legitimate enough to bring it to the court. He presented cases to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. This man is no slouch. And he's prepared all of his information. He knows when evidence is good or not good. And he's not going to bring in bad evidence before he goes to the court. Okay? He knows his stuff. He did something very interesting, this man. He took his principles and he applied them to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I got to check this out. He's a seeker. He was a seeker. I hope we're all seekers. He was a seeker. He wanted to know, what did they have to say? Well, there's a whole book. You can read it, but I'm only going to quote from one thing. The book actually is called The Testimony of the Evangelists. I like the subtitle of The Gospels Examined by the Rule of Evidence. My non-believing friend, please read the book. This is not inspired writings. This doesn't claim to be miraculous. This is just natural human stuff. You can't deny. Let me read you his quote. In his book, it was therefore impossible that they could have persisted in affirming the truths they have narrated had not Jesus actually been raised from the dead, and had they not known this fact as certain as they knew any other fact. Do you see what we're talking about? Facts. To know the resurrection happened. I don't expect you to know it happened just from the few hours we spent together. So if you're still believing it happened, hang on to that belief, but dig deeper. I want you to know it happened. It happened. And the evidence shows it. And I can take that evidence and show it to my non-believing friend. And you know, it doesn't stop there. I can't tell you the confirmation in my... I've been a Christian now for over 40 years. But when I started digging in like this 5 years ago, it's about 5 or 6 years ago, I started going into this material. It has turned me inside out. I get chills. It's no longer a belief. I know it. And man, is this earth shaking. Yeah, there was an earthquake that day, wasn't there, at the crucifixion? Well, it was an earthquake in my life. It needs to be in your life. I started off the very first thing, put emotions at the door, because we deal with emotions and we then deal with emotions and we don't get to the truth. But I'll tell you, Christianity is not void of emotions. Don't be afraid and ashamed, but it's based on fact. It's based on truth. It's based on evidence, not a hoax. It's not made up. What kind of evidence would he have looked at? He would have looked at information that we looked at. Tacitus in the first century, right? Josephus in the first century. Only maybe small portions of all the evidence that he looked at. Plus he looked at documents, I'm sure, like from Lucian. Oh, there's Josephus. Who else? Oh, the artistic drawing. That was early 1800s, I think, is when they discovered it. And I'm sure he looked at things like that. But I'm sure he looked at more than that. This is what the guy lived and breathed. And we can read his book. You can buy his book. But I want to present one last information. One last piece, last few minutes, on one last bit of evidence that needs to be discussed. And it needs to be explained. Have you ever thought about his half-brother, James? He's an historical figure. Oh, yeah, we read about him in the Bible. but he's also in secular history. He's mentioned in secular history. What do we know about James? Well, we know that he was highly respected by Christians and Jews. He was born a Jew, just like his brother, his older brother, Jesus. James eventually became a Christian leader in Jerusalem. And he wrote the book of James that you find in your Bible. According to Josephus, James was executed under the authority of a high priest, Ananus? I have hard times with these Latin names. Benanus. You know what I'm saying? Oh, I didn't put the name up there. Okay. Now, scholars estimate this to have happened around 62 AD, James's death. And that's because the scholars are looking at what Josephus wrote. And Josephus wrote a lot of names about people in office, okay, at this time. Now, I'm going to read the passage. It's a little lengthy. It might take a minute or two. But I'm only reading it because I want to show you the detail. This is not made up. This man is writing some details about the event of things happening. Okay? He says, "Now Caesar, upon hearing the death of Festus, sent Albinus into Judea as procurator. But the king deprived Joseph of the high priesthood and bestowed the succession to that dignity on the son of Ananus, who was also himself called Ananus. And now the report goes that this eldest Ananus proved the most fortunate man, for he had five sons who had all performed the office of high priest to God, and who had himself enjoyed that dignity a long time formerly, which had never happened to any other of our high priests." You see the history? We're reading little bits and pieces of history, things that happened in the first century. No one can deny these things because it's there. Now, all right, I don't want to accept him. Well, then, how do you accept Abraham Lincoln? I wasn't there then. I read about it. Well, I'm reading about something that happened here in the first century. Happened to other, okay, but this younger Ananus, who, as we have told you already, took the high priesthood, was a bold man in his temper and very insolent. He was also of the sect of the Sadducees, who are very rigid in judging offenders above all the rest of the Jews, as we have already observed. When therefore Ananus was of this disposition, he thought he had a proper opportunity. Politics plays in everything, right? He had this opportunity. Festus was now dead, and Albinus was but upon the road. So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. That's just a little aside. It's just a little, oh, by the way, James was among these guys here. And that's all I'm looking at. Something that verifies that James was the brother of Jesus. He was recognized that way. And here we have some written history. The brother of Jesus, who was called Christ. And his name was James. Historical information, executed for believing what? Why was James executed? Believing that Jesus was God, the Son of God. Whoa, think that through for a minute. According to the Gospel of Matthew, what do we know about Jesus' biological family? We know a little. Remember? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers, James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not his sisters with us also? Where then did this man get all these things? And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not known without honor, except in his own hometown and his own household." His own household did not honor him, obviously excluding Mary. But his brothers didn't honor him. They all knew Jesus. This is in his town. They all knew his brothers and his family. And then Jesus goes on to say, I expect it. No honor from my own town, from my family. But watch what he says. But John wrote and 7. So his brothers said to him, this is including James, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers were believing him. A little sarcasm there. Of course it would be sarcasm. Now I'm inflecting the sarcasm because I can't hear the tone. So, the question is, you're James. Your brother's going around telling everybody he is God. He's the Son of God. Believe in him and you'll live forever. This is your brother. What would you think? Call a professional. Let's get him medicated. He's going to hurt himself. This guy is crazy. And they did think he was crazy. Mark 13:30 indicates that there were many people, well, some people thinking he was crazy. They went and tried to get him. His own brothers wanted to get them. Remember, they said, oh, Jesus, your brothers are right outside. Well, what did Jesus say? Well, who are my brothers and sisters? Well, why did they want to come and get him? Probably, and this is a guess, to help him, protect him, because he's crazy. The point is, they didn't believe. Whether they thought he was crazy at that moment, I don't know. But I do know they didn't believe. James did not believe. What changed James' mind? To change his mind, I mean, if he was at the cross, no, he wasn't there. He knew his brother was a fake. He was a liar. He would have been on the front line of telling everybody, no, he's not who he is. No, he's dead and he's in the grave. Don't you think his brother would have gone and made sure he was in the grave? The fact that he changed from that position, that mindset, to accept Jesus Christ and to put up with the persecution that we talked about over the last 3 or 4 lessons. The murdering, the torture. And James faced it, and he was executed. Let's see, I don't want to go into that. I forget exactly. He was thrown off the pinnacle or something like that, and they crashed him down when he got down. I'm not sure if they did more things to make sure he was dead. What changed this man 180 degrees to face that? Oh, that's what it was. They wanted to take him up to the top of the pinnacle to have him publicly confess to denounce it. A new, crazy faith, dangerous to believe in, easily falsifiable. And I just want to close with what Peter said. If I can get there, we are done. Oh, I had so much more. But we're going to do it another time. That's all some of the evidence, the people that we looked at. I don't want to give you Peter's words. I want to read what Peter said. How could this be if Jesus was not raised from the dead? The question isn't, was he raised from the dead? How could it be that he wasn't when you look at all the evidence? But look what Peter said. He was foreknown before the foundation of the world, but was made manifest in these last times for the sake of you, who through him, who's that him? Jesus. You are believers. Through him are believers in who? The resurrection? No, believers in God. Why? Who raised him from the dead and gave him glory so that your faith and hope are in God. There's the bottom line. 2,000 years later, there is some way I can prove it. Or else Peter's lying. The fact of his resurrection is, it cannot be denied. If you're honestly looking for truth. Thank you for your attendance and for your attentiveness. Appreciate it. Hope to see you later over at Kevin and Emily's house. Thank you.